Wait, wait, Narman objected. I'm not saying you're wrong, Caleb, but how do we jump from what just happened in Telisberg to Hayratha? I don't know, Caleb admitted. I don't know, all right? But I'm right. I know I am. Call it a hunch, call it instinct, but that's what happened. Somebody at Hayratha, with the authority, or the access at least, to doctor shipping manifests, diverted gunpowder from our own powder mill. And they blew the damn place up to keep anyone from realizing they'd done it. To get rid of any paper trail that might have led back to them or to who they sent the powder to. His expression was murderous. My God, Hayratha shipped gunpowder in 1,000-ton lots on a regular basis, Narman. We could have dozens of wagon loads of it sitting out there. But how could they coordinate something like that without that organization you all seem to be agreeing they don't have? Stainer asked quietly. All they'd really need is what the intelligence organizations back on old Terra used to call a bagman. Narman's tone was unhappy, as if he was unwillingly coming to the conclusion Caleb might have a point. If somebody did manage to divert a quantity of gunpowder from Hayratha to someone else in old Karis, possibly somebody he had never even met or contacted in any way himself, but whose address was supplied to him by a controller in Zion, then that person could have distributed it to a dozen other locations which had been set up exactly the same way. Or, for that matter, he could have kept it all in a single location, and these lone assassins we're hypothesizing about could have been given the address before they ever left Zion. I can't begin to count the number of potential failure points in something like that. But all the ones I can think of would be much more likely to simply cause someone to not get to where he needed to be than to give the operation away to the other side. And look at it from Clintran's perspective. What does he lose if it doesn't work? But if it does work, he gets something like he just got today. He kills important members of Caleb and Charlian's governments, and he does it very, very publicly, with lots of other bodies to go around. It's a statement that even if the group of four can't beat us at sea, they can still reach out into the very heart of Telisberg and hurt us. Do you think for a moment that wouldn't seem like a win-win situation for someone like him, Michael? But if you and Caleb are right, how many other lone assassins are out there? Stainer's expression was troubled. I have no idea, Narman admitted frankly. He glared out the carriage window in frustration as it crossed into Cathedral Square, less than 4 blocks from the palace. There could be scores of them, or this could have been the only one. Knowing Clintan, though, I doubt he'd have settled for one when he might have been able to get dozens into place. Why settle for a little bit of carnage when he could have a lot? You're probably right about that, Caleb said bitterly. And he'd want to underscore his statement as strongly as possible, too, Charlian added. Stainer and Caleb looked at her, and she shrugged. I think Narman's right. He's going to have been thinking in terms of as many attacks as he could contrive, within the limitations of whatever coordination system he had. And he's going to want to concentrate them in terms of timing, too. Get them in the most focused window of time he can. He's the kind who thinks in terms of hammer blows when he goes after his opponent's morale. Some kind of timetable? Caleb's expression was suddenly strained once more. You mean we're probably looking at additional attacks, scheduled to occur simultaneously? Over a short period of time, anyway, Charlian said, nodding unhappily. There's no way he could count on their being simultaneous, but they don't have to be. Don't forget the communications problem. We can talk back and forth instantaneously, but he doesn't know that. As far as he's concerned, word is going to have to spread before anyone can know to start taking precautions. And we can't get warnings out any more rapidly than by semaphores. That means he only has to achieve approximate coordination because he'd still be inside what Merlin calls our communications loop. You may have a point, Naaman conceded. On the other hand, I could see some advantages, from his perspective, to stretching things out, hitting us with a series of attacks to demonstrate we couldn't stop him from getting through to us. So, he paused suddenly, staring out the window. Then, "Stop the carriage!" he shouted. "Stop the carriage!" The carriage came to a sudden halt, and the commander of its mounted escort wheeled his horse, trotting back towards it with a puzzled expression. He had no idea what was happening, but like most of Naaman Bate's armsmen, he had a lively respect for the prince's instincts. "Out!" Naaman said to Olivia. "Out, now!" She stared at him in confusion and a sudden sparkle of fear. She had never seen his expression like that, but the crack of command in his voice had her moving before she even realized it. He pushed her towards the carriage's left-hand door, already reaching out, turning the handle. She hesitated for a moment as the door swung open, then cried out in sudden panic as her husband put his shoulder into her back and literally heaved her out the door. It was a 3-foot drop to the paving, and Olivia Bates cried out again, this time in pain, as she landed off balance and her ankle broke. But there was no time for her to think about that. Naaman was already plunging out of the carriage behind her, pinning her down, covering her with his own body. And that was when the wagon parked by the Cathedral Square exit, closest to the palace, the wagon that wasn't supposed to be there, exploded. 4. Royal Palace, City of Erastor, Princedom of Emerald, Empire of Caris. "Leave us," Olivia Bates said flatly, her expression terrible. It was night outside the bedchamber's window, a beautiful moonlit night sprinkled with the stars that were God's own jewels. A gentle breeze stirred the window drapes, night wyverns whistled sweetly, and the harsh, agonized breathing of the semi-conscious man in the bed filled her heart with grief. "But, Your Highness," the senior healer, a pasquillate bishop, began. "Leave us," she snapped. The bishop looked at her, his expression worried, his eyes dark with sympathy, and she made herself draw a deep breath. "Is there anything else you can do for him, my lord bishop?" she asked more quietly. "Can you save him?" "No, Your Highness," the bishop admitted, his voice sad but unflinching. "To be honest, I don't understand how he's lived this long. The best we can do is what we have, to ease his pain." "Then leave us," she repeated a third time, tears welling in her eyes, her voice far softer than it had been. "This is my husband. He will die with his hand in mine in this room we have shared for 27 years, and I will be alone with him, my lord. I will bear him company, and I will witness his death. And if he speaks again before the end, what he says will be for my ears and no others. Now leave us, please. I have little time with him, and I refuse to lose any of it." The bishop looked at her for a moment longer, then bowed his head. "As you wish, Your Highness," he said softly. "Shall I send in Father Zahn?" "No," Princess Olivia said, staring down at her husband's face and holding his remaining hand in hers. The bishop started to argue, then made himself stop. Father Zahn Trahlman, the royal household's official confessor, was actually more of a tutor to Naaman and Olivia's children than the keeper of the prince's conscience. The prince, the bishop thought, had never been as observant a man as the church might have wished. The bishop was a man of strong reformist beliefs himself, and Prince Naaman's courage and willingness to speak in the cause of reforming Mother Church's faults and healing her wounds had won his admiration and gratitude. Yet he could wish that at this moment, it wasn't his decision, he reminded himself. It was Princess Olivia's. Father Zahn had already administered extreme unction and presumably heard the prince's confession before the princess had sent him to comfort the children. But who would comfort her in this terrible hour, the bishop wondered? Who would hold her hand as she held her dying husband's? "Very well, Your Highness," he said very quietly. "If you should decide you need me, send word." "Thank you, my lord. But I think that will be unnecessary," she told him with heartbreaking serenity. "I'm sure you're needed by the other victims of this attack. Go. Do what you can for them with my thanks and my blessing." The bishop bowed, then gathered up the lesser clergy with his eyes. The door closed behind them, and Olivia leaned closer to the bed, resting her head on the pillow with her forehead touching Naaman's cheek. "I'm here, love," she said softly. "I'm here." His left eye was covered in a thick dressing, but his right eye opened. It blinked slowly, the tiny movement of his eyelid heavy with effort, then turned his head and looked at her. "Ear plug," he got out, and Olivia astonished herself with a soft, weeping laugh. "Oh, Naaman!" She cupped the uninjured side of his face with her free hand. "Oh, my love, who but you would worry about that at a time like this?" He said nothing, but there was a flicker of something almost like amusement under the pain and the drug clouds in his eye, and she shook her head. "I don't know what happened to your earplug," she told him. "No one found anything when the healers examined you, anyway. Maybe they just had other things on their mind than looking in your ears, you know." "Make sure later," he whispered. "I will," she promised. "I will. Now hush, my love. Don't worry about anything. Not now." "Love you," he said. "Always have. Never told you so enough." "You think I didn't know?" She smoothed hair from his brow. "I knew. I always knew. And you saved me today, Naaman." She managed a wavering smile. "I know you've never thought you were a properly heroic figure, but you were always hero enough for me, and never more than today." His answering smile was heartbreaking, but his eyes slipped slowly shut once more, and her grip on his hand tightened. Had he heard her? Did he understand? Her ankle was broken, the left side of her face was one enormous bruise, and it had taken 14 stitches to close the gash on her left shoulder. But not a single member of their escort had survived. Neither had the coachman. And if Naaman hadn't protected her with his own body, she would be dead or dying too. It was important that he know that, and she heard a foot on the marble bedchamber floor behind her, and her head jerked up, her eyes flashing with sudden, grief-fueled fury as she wheeled. "How dare you intrude?" she began, then stopped abruptly. "I came as soon as I could, Olivia," Merlin Athroy said. "I couldn't risk it before dark, and getting away from Tellisburg under the circumstances." He shrugged, crossing to the bed, and sank to one knee beside her chair. He held out his arms to her, and she threw herself into them, weeping on his mailed shoulder, as she had refused to let anyone else see her weep. "Take him to your cave, Merlin," she sobbed. "Take him to your cave. Let Owl save him." "I can't," Merlin whispered into her ear, stroking her hair with a sinewy hand. "I can't. There's not enough time. We'd lose him before I ever got him there." "No." She struggled against his embrace, striking his unyielding cuirass with her fists. It was as if his arrival had offered her the hope of a last-minute reprieve, and the destruction of that hope was more than she could bear. "No." "Maybe if I'd been able to get here sooner, then, maybe," Merlin said, holding her with implacable strength. "But I couldn't. and Owl's been monitoring Olivia. I don't think we would have been able to save him even if I had been able to get here sooner. It's only the nanotech keeping him alive now, and it's burning out, using itself up. Then why are you here? She demanded, furious in her sorrow. Why are you even here? Because Charlian and Caleb and I love you, he said, and because I can at least give you this. She stared at him as he put his hands on her shoulders and very gently settled her back into her chair before he stood once more. He reached into his belt pouch and extracted a lightweight headset of silvery wire and gently adjusted it on Narman's head. Nothing happened for a moment, but then the eye which had closed opened once more. Merlin? Narman's voice was stronger than it had been, clearer, and Merlin nodded. More of your magic? Narman asked. No more magic than the rest of me, Narman, Merlin told him. I'm sorry I couldn't get here sooner. I guess when you're 1,000 years old, you tend to lose track of time, Narman managed, and Olivia laughed through her tears, covering her mouth with both hands. It's not much, Merlin told her, his sapphire eyes deeper and darker than the sea. But it's all I can do right now. What? The headset will keep his mind clear, and I programmed it to shut down the pain centers. Merlin managed a smile of his own. I don't think you have much time, Olivia, but the time you do have will be clear, and it will be yours. He touched her face very gently, then looked back down at Narman. It's been an interesting trip, Narman, he said, laying his hand on the dying prince's shoulder. And it's been a privilege working with you. Thank you for everything you've done, but now I think I'll leave you with your wife. God bless Narman. Hopefully we'll have a chance to talk again someday. He squeezed Narman's shoulder and looked at Olivia. I'll be out in the garden listening if you should need me, he said gently, and vanished back through the window by which he had arrived. Olivia Bates looked after him for a moment, tearful eyes shining with gratitude, and then she turned back to her husband and reached for his hand once more. 5. Plaza of Martyrs, the Temple, City of Zion, the Temple Lands. Robert, you have to come, Zamsin Trinair said flatly. No, Zamsin, actually I don't. Robert drew chair and looked steadily back at the Chancellor. Trinair's expression was an odd mixture of anxiety, frustration, distaste for what he himself was saying, and anger, but the Treasurer's face was calm, his eyes almost, not quite, but almost, tranquil. This is not a time to be suggesting there's division between us, Robert, Trinair said. Anybody who's worrying about whether or not there's division between me and Zaspar Clintan on this issue has either already figured out there is one, or he's such a drooling idiot he probably can't put on his own shoes without assistance, Duchenne replied. And frankly, if someone does realize I'm at odds, let's say, with Zaspar Clintan over this ritualized butchery of his, that's fine with me. Even the Book of Shula reserves the full punishment for genuine, unrepentant heretics, Zamsin, not for people who simply happen to have pissed Zaspar off by having the audacity to survive when he ordered them to lie down and die. He'd been wrong, Trinair realized. Duchenne's eyes weren't tranquil. They were those of a man who didn't care any longer. A chill went through the Chancellor as he realized that, and he felt something altogether too much like panic fluttering somewhere inside his chest. You told Zaspar, and me, you wouldn't oppose him on this if we wouldn't oppose you on the matters that were important to you, he said carefully. And I have no intention, to my shame, of openly opposing him. There are, however, limits to the stains I'm prepared to accept upon my soul. And this is one of them. You and I both know. Any confessions of heresy, or blasphemy, or, God help us all, Shanwei worship were gotten out of those men only by torture. And 18-10 of them died rather than perjure themselves to suit Zaspar's purposes. Do you truly have any concept at all of the courage it took to defy that kind of savagery? They may be schismatics, but they are not blasphemers, idolaters or demon worshippers, and they damn well haven't sacrificed any children to Shan Wei, and you know that as well as I do. So if my refusal to participate in his vengeance upon men whose only true crime was to defeat his unprovoked attack on their families and their homeland incenses him so completely that he chooses to make our breach public, so be it. Robert, you can't survive if that happens. If he openly turns against you, denounces you, you'll go exactly the same way these Corisians are about to. I could be in worse company, Duchenne said flatly, his voice cold. In fact, I'm inclined to think I couldn't be in better company. Unfortunately, I'm no longer as certain as I once was that my eternal destination is going to be the same as theirs. I can only pray it will. Trinair's blood ran cold. He'd known Duchenne was becoming ever more embittered, ever more sickened by Clintan's policies, but this was the harshest, most unyielding denunciation of the Grand Inquisitor Duchenne had dared to voice, even to him. And if the Treasurer really pushed this, if it did result in an open break between him and the Grand Inquisitor, Trinair knew which of them would survive. In some ways, that might almost be a relief. Yet with Duchenne gone, the Chancellor would be alone against Clintan, with only the effective non-entity of Alain Magwer as a potential ally, which meant... "Don't say things like that," he pled, waving both hands in calming motions. "I know you're angry, and I know this whole thing makes you sick at heart, but if you push Zaspar far enough and you go down, there'll be nobody left to oppose him even slightly." The Chancellor grimaced, his expression more than half ashamed. "I won't be able to, and I know it. Not now." "He has rather saddled the whirlwind for all of us to ride, hasn't he?" Duchenne said sardonically. "Why did we let him get away with it, do you think?" His eyes suddenly stabbed the Chancellor to the heart. "Because the notion of doing what we knew was right didn't matter enough for us to bestir ourselves out of our luxurious little lives? Because we didn't give a single good goddamn about our responsibilities to Mother Church? Was that the reason, Zamsin?" "Don't you dare try that with me," Trinair snapped. "Maybe that was the reason. But you were right here in the middle of it with the rest of us, Robert. You could have said stop any time you wanted. Maybe it wouldn't have accomplished anything, but you could at least have made the attempt, and you didn't, did you? You didn't even try. So now you've discovered your conscience. Fine, I'm happy for you, but don't you take your newfound piety and try to cram it down my throat. You're so fucking proud of how noble you've become. Well, that's fine. But if you think you're going to shame me into standing beside you when Zaspar decides to have you put to the question, to prove you're just as heretical as Samuel Wilson ever was, you've got another thing coming." "So you do have a little spine left," Duchenne said with a thin, cold smile. "Pity you didn't turn up earlier. And before you start in again, now I'm not trying to pretend I wasn't just as spineless and just as blind to the consequences as you were when Zaspar launched us on this little disaster. I've never pretended I wasn't those things. The difference between us is that, yes, I am ashamed of myself, and there are limits to the additional complicity I'm willing to assume. And frankly, I don't really care if the thought of finding yourself all alone with Zaspar after I'm gone makes you feel threatened. I'm not looking for martyrdom, Samson. It might be better for my soul if I were, but I'm not prepared to go that far. Yet, anyway. and I'm not going to have any public shouting matches with Zaspar. I undoubtedly should, but you and I both know it would be a futile gesture. So you just run along back to him and Alain. The three of you go and eat your fried potato slices at the spectacle this afternoon. Drink your beer and enjoy the entertainment. But I'm not going to be there, because I've got something a lot more pressing to spend my time on. I'm sure that if Zaspar and that loathsome slime-toed Reno want to know where I am, they can ask Major Fandies. No doubt he'd be delighted to tell them. And if you want to tell him where I am, that's fine with me too. Because where I'll be, Samson, is in the temple, praying for God's forgiveness for not being out in that plaza denouncing Zaspar Clintan for the foul, sadistic, murdering bastard he is. Robert Duchesne gave the Chancellor of the Church of God a waiting, one more cold, stony glare, and slammed out of the office. Trinair stared after him, shocked and stunned by the power of the treasurer's denunciation, and listened to the boots of Duchesne's personal guard clattering down the hallway behind Major Constanzo Fandis, as the lot of them tried to keep up with the furiously striding treasurer.
"Well, I see Samson has finally deigned to join us," Zaspar Clintan said, watching from the central platform as the Chancellor slipped unobtrusively into the silent watching ranks of the church's vicars. "Better late than never, I suppose. And where do you think our good friend Robert might be, Willem?"
"Somewhere else, Your Grace," Willem Reno replied with a sigh.
"I'm afraid his absence is going to be remarked upon." "Of course it is," Clintan spoke from the corner of his mouth, lips scarcely moving, as he looked out across the packed approaches of the Plaza of Martyrs. "That's why the bastard's doing it."
"I agree, Your Grace, but I trust we're not going to make the mistake of underestimating him."
"Underestimate Robert Duchesne?" Clintan snorted. "That would be extraordinarily difficult to do, Willem. Oh, I'll grant you he's got more guts than Trinair, not to mention 5 or 6 times as much brains as Maguire ever had. In fact, let's be honest, if there's one of the other three who would ever have the courage and the willingness to speak out against the jihad, it would have to be Duchesne. But he's not ready for an open break, and the truth is that whatever he may think, he never will be."
"I'm inclined to agree with you in most regards, Your Grace," Reno said, choosing his words with some care. "All the same, I can't help thinking Vicar Robert has changed a great deal over the last few years. I don't think we can afford to overlook the possibility that he may change still further."
"You mean grow big enough balls to consider an open confrontation with me?" Clintan asked calmly, turning to look directly at the Archbishop of Wuxi for the first time. Reno was obviously a bit nonplussed by the question, and the Grand Inquisitor chuckled coldly. "If it were just a matter of screwing up his nerve, he'd already have done it, Willem," he said flatly. "Whatever I may think of him, I'm willing to admit he's no coward. It's not fear holding him back, not any more, anyway. And I don't need any spies to tell me he hates my guts either. For that matter, I don't need any bedardists to tell me that somewhere down inside he's come to hate himself as well for not standing up to me. And that kind of hate can eat at a man until it finally drives him into doing something he'd never do otherwise. All of that's true. But he's still not going to push it to the point of an open break."
"May I ask why you're so certain of that, Your Grace?" Reno asked cautiously.
"It's very simple, really," Clintan shrugged. "If he pushes me into having him removed, there won't be anyone left to argue with me. You think Trinair or Maguire are going to draw any lines and dare me to step across them?" The Grand Inquisitor's laugh was a short, contemptuous bark. "Not in a thousand years, Willem, not in a thousand years. And Robert knows that. He knows all his precious projects, all his kinder, gentler plans and pious aspirations, any possibility of restraining my excesses, will go straight into the crapper with him. And he's not going to let that happen. The way he sees it, the only chance he has for redemption is to do some good in the world, to make up for all those years when he was just as committed as any of the rest of us to the practical side of maintaining Mother Church's authority. He can't do that if he's dead. And that, more than any fear of the question or the punishment, is what's going to stop him. He'll always be able to find some way to rationalize not coming directly at me, because it's up to him to do whatever he can to minimize the damage I'm doing. Reno simply looked at him. For once, even the Schulerite adjutant was at a loss for words, and Clintan chuckled again, more naturally. Robert, unfortunately, is one of those people who believe man actually has a better nature. He genuinely thinks he can appeal to that kinder, gentler side he's sure most everyone really has. He doesn't recognize that the reason God gave Schuler authority to decree the discipline of Mother Church is that, thanks to Shan Wei, man has no better nature. Not any longer, anyway. God and Langhorne tried Robert's idea of loving gentleness, of begging men to do the right thing, and mankind repaid them by embracing Shan Wei's foulness. What? Robert thinks he's greater than holy Langhorne, greater than God himself? That mankind is going to suddenly discover a better nature it hasn't had since the very dawn of creation, just because he, the great Robert Duchesne, is determined to appeal to it? The Grand Inquisitor's lips worked as if he wanted to spit on the ground, but he made himself draw a deep breath, nostrils flaring. Whatever may be going through his mind, he's simply incapable of understanding that man won't embrace God's will and accept God's authority without the iron rod of discipline. Humans have demonstrated again and again that unless they're made to do what they know God wants them to do, they won't do it. They have neither the wit, nor the will, nor the understanding to do it, and they're too dull-witted even to recognize their own stupidity without us to make God's will plain to them. That's why Robert doesn't understand the Inquisition's job, its responsibilities, its duty. He's not willing to admit what has to be done, so he pretends it doesn't have to be. He's willing to condemn us for doing it, as long as his hands are clean, and he genuinely believes we're unnecessarily harsh, that we could renounce that iron rod if we were only willing to. Well, we can't, unless we're prepared to see everything Mother Church stands for go down in ruin, but that's all right, because as long as he believes he can continue to do things behind the scenes to mitigate our excesses, he'll go right on preserving his ability to do them. He'll make whatever compromises with his own soul he has to in order to accomplish that. And what that means, Willem, is that it would be almost impossible to drive him to a point where he decided he had nothing left to lose and came at us openly. Because he'll go right on clinging to that responsibility to do good, to offset our evil. Reno glanced away for a moment, looking up at the sky above Zion, touched with the colder, brighter autumn blue. The last blossoms had fallen from the elaborate gardens beyond the Plaza of Martyrs' elaborate fountains, and fall colour was creeping into the foliage. It would be winter again all too soon, and snow and ice would close in around the temple once more. He thought about that, then looked back at his superior. "I hope you're right, Your Grace," he said. There was an unusual edge of doubt in his voice, however. Not disagreement, simply a note of reservation. Clintan heard it, but he chose to let it pass. One of the things that made Rayner valuable to him was that the adjutant was perhaps the only person left who would argue with him if he thought Clintan was wrong. "I am right," the Grand Inquisitor said instead. "And if I'm not, I've got you and Major Fandies keeping an eye on him, don't I? We'll know if he starts to become a genuine threat. As for his absence this afternoon, I'll let him have that much. It's not as if anyone else is going to ignore today's lesson, is it? Besides," Clintan smiled suddenly, the smile of a slash lizard scenting blood, "it's useful, in its own way." "I beg your pardon, Your Grace?" "Willem, Willem," Clintan shook his head, still smiling. "Think about it. First, he's such a convenient focus for anyone who might disagree with us. All we have to do is watch for anyone who seems inclined to suck up to him instead of to me, and we'll know where the real weak links are. And second, Trinair and Makewear are so busy trying to stay out of the line of fire between me and Robert that neither one of them is even going to consider doing something to make me think they're choosing his side instead of mine. Oh, they may side with him over some purely technical issues, like how we balance the books and pay for the jihad, but not on anything fundamental. From that perspective, it's far better to have him right where he is, driving them into our arms in their desperation to make it clear they're not rushing into his." Rayner was still thinking about that when the bells began to ring. Sir Gwilym Manthyr could hardly stay on his own feet, yet he wrapped his right arm around the man beside him, draping the other Carisian's left arm across his own shoulders, and somehow supporting the shambling, stumbling weight. The two of them staggered along, two more penitents in the rough, scratchy burlap robes that covered their savagely scarred, emaciated nakedness. For now, at least. It was a beautiful day, Manthyr thought, listening to the magnificent silver-throated bells of Zion, as he looked around at the handful of his men who had survived this long. There weren't many. He didn't have a definite count, but they couldn't be more than 30, and he was amazed the number was that high. "Tough, those Carisian seamen," he thought. "Too tough and too stupid for their own good. The smart ones gave up and died. But that's all right, because I'm not very smart either, I guess." He knew every one of those 30 shambling, broken wrecks of human beings that had been given the option. Confess their heresy, admit their blasphemies and all of the hellish crimes to which they had set their hands in the service of their accursed emperor and empress, and they would face the garrote, not the punishment. Some of his men, a handful, had taken that offer, and Manthyr couldn't find it in his heart to condemn them for it. As he told Lancer Sversman a seeming eternity ago, there was only so much any man could endure, and there was no shame in breaking under the savagery of the question. But if there was no shame in breaking, there was pride in not breaking, and his heart swelled as he looked around at those stumbling, crippled, tormented ruins, and knew exactly what they'd already endured without yielding. As long as one of them, was still on his feet, still defiant, Sir Gwilym Manthyr would stand beside him at the very gates of hell. They were his, and he was theirs, and he would not, could not, break faith with them. They marched across the plaza, and he saw the heaps of wood, the charred wooden posts arranged on the marble flags, many of them cracked now with the heat of past fires, between the fountains and the temple's soaring colonnade. They marked where others of Clintan's victims had already died, those posts, and he watched his men being separated from one another, dragged to those heaps of wood, chained to those grim, scorched posts. He watched inquisitors coating their bodies with pitch that would take the flame and cling to them, even as it offered their flesh a brief, transitory protection that would make their dying even longer and harder. He saw leather gloves, knuckles reinforced with steel studs, striking anyone who didn't move fast enough, who showed any trace of fight. They had to use those weighted fists quite often, he thought, watching, taking it all in. When it was his turn to appear before the throne of God, he wanted to be certain he had it all straight as he gave his testimony against the men who had twisted and perverted everything God stood for. Then all of his men were chained, fastened atop their pyres, and there was only him. A pair of inquisitors started to drag him past his men, but he found the strength to shake off their hands and walk, slowly but steadily, under his own power, making eye contact for one last time with every man he passed, towards the platform which had been reserved for him. The platform with the wheel and the rack, the white-hot irons waiting in their nests of glowing coals. He longed for one final opportunity to defy the Inquisition, to speak for his men, to ridicule the charges against them, but they'd taken that from him when they cut out his tongue. He could still scream. They'd proven that to him. But they'd silenced his ability to deny the confession they were going to read and attribute to him. He'd held out. He'd never admitted or signed a single damn thing. But that wasn't the story they were going to tell. He knew that. They'd explained it to him in smirking detail, in a last-ditch effort to break him into actually signing, and it grieved him that he could never set the record straight. Not so much for himself, but because it meant he couldn't speak out for his men either. It doesn't matter, he thought as he climbed the steps to the platform, eyes hard with hate and defiance as they met Zaspar Clintans in person at last. Anybody who'd believe Clintans lies in the first place would never believe anything I said. And anyone who knows the truth about Clintan already knows what I would have said if I could. Those people, my emperor and my empress and my navy, they know. And the time will come when they will avenge every one of my men. He saw the torches, flames pale in the cool autumn sunlight, as the inquisitors strode towards his chained and helpless men, and his belly tightened. They were going to burn the others first. Let him listen to their screams and watch their agonizing deaths before it was his turn. It was the kind of refinement he'd come to expect out of Zaspar Clintan's Inquisition. Two more inquisitors seized his arms, stretching them out, chaining them to the rack, and Zaspar Clintan stepped closer to him. The Grand Inquisitor's face was studiously calm, set in stern lines of determination, as he prepared to play out the final line of this carefully scripted farce. "You have heard the judgment and sentence of Holy Mother Church upon you for your blasphemy, your heresy, your wanton defiance of God and allegiance to Shanwei, Quilim, Manthia," he said, his voice carrying clearly. "Have you anything to say before that sentence is carried out?" Clintan's eyes glittered with satisfaction as he asked the question he knew Manthia couldn't answer. There was no way for his victim to voice his defiance, demonstrate his rejection of the judgment and sentence which had been pronounced upon him, yet there was also no way for anyone in that watching crowd to know his voice had been taken from him before the question was even asked. They would see only the terrified heretic, too cowed by the onrushing approach of the eternal damnation he had earned, to say a single word. Sir Gwilym Manthia looked back at the gloating Grand Inquisitor as Clintan savoured his triumph, and then he spat squarely into the vicar's face. 6. St. Belair's Church and Madame Reva Parsan's townhouse. Sidar City, Republic of Sidamark. "I don't like it, Father," Stan Malden said unhappily as he knelt in the closed booth of the confessional. I don't like it at all. Where's it coming from? I don't know, brother, Father Laurie Tregear, the rector of St. Belair's church, replied, although he wasn't as sure of that as he would have liked. It's all so wrong, Maldon said, his eyes anxious, and Tregear smiled affectionately at him. Brother Stan was in his late 50s, thinning hair going steadily white, and there wasn't a malicious bone in his entire body. There wasn't an ambitious one either, as far as Tregear could tell, which probably explained why Brother Stan was still only a sexton of the Order of the Quill at his age. It certainly wasn't because of lack of ability, faith, or industry. A librarian by training and inclination alike, Maldon was an absent-minded, otherworldly sort who was always happiest puttering about in the histories he was responsible for maintaining and updating. He had a sharp, analytical brain, but one which was altogether too poorly suited for considering ugly truths outside the covers of his beloved histories. He was inclined to assume that since he wished ill to no one, no one could possibly wish ill to him, which, unfortunately, was no longer true even in the Republic, if it ever had been. At least the old fellow's had the sense to keep his feelings mostly to himself, Tregear thought, or I hope to Langhorne he has at any rate. I agree it's wrong, Brother Stan, he said, but I'm afraid it's also fairly inevitable as well. He shook his head, his expression sad. Men who are afraid do ugly things, and one of the things they do first is to strike out at and try to destroy whatever frightens them. Maldon nodded, although Tregear was pretty sure the sexton's understanding was more intellectual than emotional. The priest wished he were a more inspired speaker, better able to explain what he saw so clearly, but he was a teacher more than a preacher, without the gift of language which God had given so generously to some other priests. He tried not to envy their greater gifts and to appreciate the ones he had been given, but that was harder to do in times like these. All I can tell you, brother, is that I urge you to go home, go about your business and do your best to, well, keep your head down. Tregear's smile was fleeting. I don't know where the fellows you're talking about are likely to go in the end, but I advise you to keep yourself out of their sights. But they're threatening people, Father, Maldon protested, and they're claiming it's what God and Langhorne want them to do. I understand that, brother, Tregear said as patiently as he could, but there's nothing you can do about it, and if you confront them you only run the risk of pouring oil on the flames. Trust me, men who say the things you say they said aren't going to respond well to reasonable argument. He gazed into the sexton's eyes, willing Maldon to simply take his word for it. He didn't want to have to tell the gentle librarian that if he confronted the temple loyalist toughs he had described, he was only going to bring their violence down on his own head. And he didn't want to have to explain that he was beginning to fear no amount of reasonable argument could head off what he was afraid was coming. "Are you sure, Father?" Maldon shook his head. The writ says we're supposed to stand up for what we know is right and denounce what we know is wrong. Yes, we are. And you have, to me, Tregear said firmly. You'll just have to trust me when I say. I'll bring it to the attention of the proper ears. That's my responsibility, not yours. Maldon still looked unhappy and distressed, but he finally nodded. Good, Brother Stan. Good. Tregear patted the older man on the arm. Now, about those sins of yours. He shook his head and smiled. I believe I can safely say they're all scarcely even venal this time. So light a candle to the holy Bedard, leave an extra silver in Pasquale's basket this Wednesday, and say 10 Hail Langhorns. Understood? Yes, Father. Maldon agreed obediently, and the young priest stood and began escorting him down the nave. "I know you're worried," he said quietly as they reached the front steps. "To be honest, so am I. because these are worrying times. But you're a good man, and if you'll forgive my saying so, a gentle one. I think you'll best serve by lending your prayers to those of all good and God-fearing people, and, he looked the sexton firmly in the eye, by staying home, keeping out from underfoot, and not making things worse. Understand me? Yes, father. Maldon managed a wry smile and nodded again, more firmly. Good, Tregear repeated. Now go home. He pointed, like a stern grandfather, and the white-haired Maldon laughed and obeyed the imperious gesture. The priest watched him until he turned the corner, then turned and walked briskly back into his church. It would be tight, but he had time to talk to those proper ears he had promised Maldon he'd speak to between now and afternoon mass if he hurried. "I can see why Father Larie was upset, Your Eminence," Eva Passan said. She stood gazing out her windows at North Bay once more. The Navy of God galleons had long since departed for Sing Wu's passage, and the blue water sparkled under the September sun, busy with the weathered, tan sails of Siddhar City's teeming commerce. It would be winter again soon enough, she thought, with icy snow, rain, and the bay the colour of a polished steel blade. She wasn't looking forward to that. In fact, there were several things she wasn't looking forward to, and she was frankly surprised they'd held off this long. "What worries me most is Father Larie's fear that he knows these men," Zazin Khania said unhappily. "Surely that doesn't come as a surprise, Your Eminence?" Eva turned to face him, and her expression was a strange mix of compassion and exasperation. "Did you truly believe this was all purely spontaneous? Something just naturally bubbling up out of Siddermark's burning loyalty to Mother Church and the people currently controlling her policies?" Khania looked at her for a moment, then shrugged unhappily. "No, of course not," he said. "I mean, in some ways I'd like to believe it's purely out of loyalty to the Church, even if a mob mentality is a dangerous thing. Mobs can do horrible things, and I've seen it. But if Father Larie is right, if these men Brother Stan is talking about really do come out of Bishop Executor Baker's or Father Zohan's offices, then we may be looking at something a lot worse than some kind of spontaneous vigilantism." "Of course we are," Passan told him flatly. "And Father Larie is right, Your Eminence. I already had the names of four of the men he's talking about, and at least one of them works directly for Father Samin." Khania looked at her sharply, and his expression tightened. Father Zohans Patkover, the intendant of Siddhar for the last 16 months, was about as ardent as even a Schulerite came. Khania couldn't be positive, but unless he was sadly mistaken, Patkover had been hand-picked by Zaspar Clintan for his current post specifically because of that ardency. The Inquisitor General would have made it his business to be certain he had a reliable intendant in a place like Old Province, the original heartland of the Republic of Siddermark under any circumstances. These days, with the upsurge in reformist sympathies throughout the Republic, Clintan was going to be more focused on his intendant's reliability than ever, especially since Bishop Executor Baker Sekor was apparently at least a little more sympathetic to the reformists than Archbishop Praedwin Lacan, his immediate superior. Of course, Sekor was also a bishop executor of the old school, a bureaucrat first and foremost, not someone likely to succumb to a sudden rush of piety. He'd follow his superior's instructions to the letter, whatever his personal views might be. Still, it was obvious to Khania that the bishop-executor wasn't getting out of his way to stamp on peaceful, process-oriented reformists, which probably explained why he'd been assigned a more activist intendant last year. Father Samin Earnhardt, however, worried that Archbishop of Glacier Heart, even more than Patkover, Zohannes Patkover was zealous about keeping a close eye on the reliability of the local clergy, but Earnhardt was even more zealous, which undoubtedly explained why he'd been assigned as Paco Vea's immediate subordinate for what was euphemistically termed special functions. In effect, Earnhardt was responsible for managing the Inquisition's covert operations. Not information gathering, not observation, but active operations, offensive operations, one might better say, intended to identify, unmask, and destroy the enemies of God and Mother Church, no matter where or who they might be. And, no matter what he had to do, to accomplish his mission, which had to suit Earnhardt just fine. As Schuller had written in the very first chapter of his book, after all, extremism in the pursuit of godliness can never be a sin. Kanier wasn't at all convinced Seyman Earnhardt had ever bothered to read any of the rest of the Book of Schuller. "You really didn't know, did you, Your Eminence?" Parsan said quietly. "About Earnhardt?" Kanier pursed his lips and exhaled heavily, then shrugged. "I knew about him, of course. We've been keeping an eye out for him, but I didn't realize Bishop Executor Baker was working that directly with him. Or vice versa. To be honest, I'm not sure how directly involved the Bishop Executor actually is," Parsan said. "I know Potcover has both his hands in the pie right up to the elbow, and Earnhardt's his chief kitchen assistant. On the other hand, I know where both of them are. I can keep an eye on them, and..." Her voice turned grimmer, her eyes harder. "If I have to, I can put my hand on them any time I need to as well. I know you don't want to hear that sort of thing, Your Eminence, but I'm afraid I've become rather addicted to that aphorism about the archangels helping those who help themselves." She looked at Kanier, who nodded. She was right. He didn't want to hear about that sort of thing, but what he wanted and what he needed were two different things. "The thing that bothers me most about Father Lurie's report," Parsan continued, "is what Brother Stan had to say about Leon Bazkai. He's been turning into a really nasty piece of work, Your Eminence, and until today I generally thought he was a spontaneous bigot." "What do you mean?" "Bazkai's an interesting fellow, Your Eminence. He's a temple loyalist, but he's also a leveller, and he's been getting more active as an organizer over the past several months, more visible and more vocal, and he's been moving steadily further and further towards their violent wing ever since Clintan declared his embargo against Carisian trade." Kania's mouth tightened. He had never heard Basque's name before, but he was more familiar with the levelers than he wanted to be. In truth, he was more than a little sympathetic to at least three-quarters of their platform. He was less than convinced about the need for the complete and total destruction of capitalism, yet he was certainly willing to admit the system as it existed, especially in the temple lands, where senior churchmen used their privileged positions, entrenched corruption and cronyism to amass staggering fortunes, while squeezing out any competition, could and did create huge inequities. That was the main reason the levelers had originated in the temple lands, and many reformists were at least mildly sympathetic to the levelers' core arguments. These days the levelers were more active in the Republic of Sidamark than anywhere else, however, which was precisely because the Republic's level of tolerance was so much higher than that of most other mainland realms. As far as he was aware, they had virtually no representation in Caris, but that was understandable enough, given the general Carisian enthusiasm for trade and individual self-betterment. Carisians liked capitalism a lot, and they weren't especially interested in hearing from people who disapproved of it. It was ironic, perhaps, that the realm in which the movement operated most openly was the one where the inequalities against which it inveighed were least pronounced. But that didn't make it something the Republic's civil authorities embraced with open arms, either. In Kanye's opinion, though, the levelers' position that all men and women were equally children of God and therefore should take equal care of one another, was straight out of the Holy Writ. There was nothing the least objectionable about that, and the majority of levellers advocated peaceful means of pursuing their platform, although strikes and work stoppages had a tendency to turn violent at the best of times, especially in places like the Temple Lands, or quite a few of the border states between them and the Republic. And God only knew what would happen to a batch of levellers who tried civil disobedience, someplace like the Hachong Empire. A growing number of levellers did advocate a more proactive stance, however. What Pa San had just called their violent wing was tired of peaceful remonstrance and petitions for redress. Its members had come increasingly to the view that no one would ever take them seriously until they convinced the rest of the world they were serious, and that would require violence. Personally, Kania thought they were out of their minds if they believed they could reform society into genuine egalitarianism by killing anyone who disagreed with them, although he supposed that when the rest of the world was busy going insane anyway, they might be excused for thinking they saw an opportunity to implement some of their own reforms. But still, "A leveller working hand in glove with the Inquisition," he said. "That sounds suitably bizarre. They don't usually find one another congenial company, do they?" Pa San agreed. "That's what bothers me about this. Baskai's a printer and a pamphleteer, and he's produced some fairly inflammatory stuff for several years now. The Republic's authorities have known exactly who he was and where to find him, but however inflammatory he may have been, he was always careful to stay away from advocating any form of violence. Only that emphasis of his has been changing over the last year or so, since shortly after Park Over was assigned to the Cedar Archbishopric, in fact. And he's been focusing more and more of his complaints about the unfair, unequal distribution of wealth on the empire of Caris and Carisians in general. Not reformists? Carisians? Well, in some ways an anti-Carisian bias from somebody like a leveller is understandable enough," Pa San pointed out. "If there's any city in the entire world whose society is further from the leveller ideal than Tellisberg's, it could only be Shangmi, and that's heading in the opposite direction." Despite himself, Kania chuckled at her disgusted expression. Shangmi, the capital of the Hachong Empire, made Zion seem like a hotbed of reform. But Baskai's been concentrating on how damned rich Karis is supposed to be getting out of this war, Pa San continued, her expression becoming much more somber once more. What with sucking the lifeblood out of legitimate Sidamakian businesses because of the embargo and the way the trading houses are evading it, as nearly as I can tell, he buys into the theory that what this is really all about is greed, and that Karis, rather than needing every single mark to pay for the navy it needs to survive, is deliberately siphoning the Republic's wealth into its own purse out of sheer avarice. Its indecently wealthy plutocrats are actively pushing a deliberately aggressive militant foreign policy to promote the war in order to fill their purses with more of the deserving world's marks. If it weren't for their greed, this whole thing could have been settled ages ago by a simple appeal to the Grand Vicar's justice." "That's ridiculous." "Forgive me, Your Eminence, but it's always seemed to me that the very first thing that happens with any zealot is that he removes his brain just in case any thoughts that might challenge his zealotry should happen to stray into it. Present company excepted, of course." "Ouch," Kania winced. "Do you really think of me as a zealot?" "For certain definitions of the word, I certainly do," Pa San replied calmly. "On the other hand, I'm a zealot. For that matter, there's zealotry and then there's zealotry. And while I may be prejudiced by my own perspective, I don't think of you as a fanatic zealot. Just a zealous zealot. Thank you for your exquisite tact, my dear. Don't mention it, Your Eminence. She smiled at him, but then her expression sobered again. Anyway, the reason Bascai came to my attention had less to do with his excoriation of the Empire of Caris than it did with his growing hostility towards Carisians in general. In particular, he's been focusing on how Carisian refugees here in the Republic have been taking employment away from Sidamachians. He's scarcely the only one doing that, as I'm sure you're at least as well aware as I am, but he's been a lot more organized about it than most of the loudmouths and hotheads. And now we have this suggestion that he's associated with Earnhardt somehow. And apparently, he's been accepting some printing jobs from people who are putting up broadsheets attacking the reformists as well. I knew he wasn't a huge admirer of the reformists, which always struck me as a little odd, since the reformists are a lot more sympathetic to the kind of world the Levellers want to build than someone like Clintarn or China could ever be. But it hadn't occurred to me that Earnhardt might be steering some of those printing jobs to him. "I don't think I like where you're going with this," Kinnear said slowly. "Neither do I." She turned to look out the window once more, reaching up to slowly coil and uncoil a lock of hair around her right index finger while she thought. She stood that way for several minutes, then looked back over her shoulder at the fugitive archbishop. The temple loyalists' rhetoric and invective against the reformists have been growing steadily stronger, Your Eminence. We both know that. And in the last month and a half or so, I've been hearing more and more clearly vocalized anger against the Carisians as well. The thing that's occurring to me, and Father Larie's report isn't the only reason I'm thinking this way either, is that somebody may actually be deliberately orchestrating that growth in anger and invective. That particular nasty suspicion was already running through my brain, but if Bascai, who I know is involved in it, is working directly with Earnhardt, and I think we have to very seriously consider the possibility that this extends a lot further than I thought it did. I was operating on the assumption that it was primarily an urban phenomenon, something which was strongest in the cities where the reformists and Carisians are most concentrated and political opinions are always likely to ferment more energetically than in the countryside. But if the Inquisition's the one stirring the pot, they may be nursing it along in places I hadn't even considered yet. You think this is some sort of Republic-wide plot, for want of a better word? Kania could have wished his own tone was more incredulous. Passan's slow nod of agreement didn't make him feel any better either. I don't want to call it preposterous, but it sounds awfully ambitious, even for someone like Clintarn. Our illustrious Grand Inquisitor's done something in the last 3 or 4 years to convince you he doesn't think in ambitious terms? Passan asked, just a bit derisively. Of course not. I just meant... You meant that the Republic of Sidamark is huge, and that organizing anything like this as a workable proposition would be an enormous undertaking, especially in the middle of a war. Well, yes, pretty much. At first sight, I might be inclined to agree with you, Your Eminence, she said very seriously. But consider 3 things. First, she held up her left fist, index finger extended. The Inquisition, like Mother Church herself, is everywhere. And 2, her second finger joined her index finger. At this moment, Zaspar Clintarn's concentrated more power in his hands than probably any other Grand Inquisitor in the history of Mother Church. And 3, her ring finger joined the other 2. We are in the middle of a war, which means he and Reyno are in a position to argue convincingly the Church is fighting for her very survival. Your Eminence, even priests, who fundamentally disagree with many of the things Clintan's doing right now, are acquiescing because of the church's frightened, defensive mindset. And to be honest, the Carisians' string of victories only makes that fear still stronger. Worse, Clintan's made it abundantly clear what he's willing to do to anyone he might even remotely consider an opponent or an enemy. So, added to the fear for Mother Church's survival, we have the personal fear that anyone who gets in the Inquisition's way is going to suffer for it, suffer severely. So we have the Inquisition's feelers and tentacles threaded throughout not just the Republic, but all of the mainland realms. And we have a Grand Inquisitor with a genuine iron fist and a taste for using it, and a priesthood, not just in the Inquisition, but everywhere in Mother Church, frightened by the combined challenge of the Church of Charis from without and the reformists from within, and frightened of that iron fist of his. Do you really think, under those circumstances, that someone like Zaspar Clintan and Willem Reyno wouldn't see the potential to destabilize a republic of Siddermark they've hated and distrusted literally for decades? I know the very thought is revolting, but try to put yourself inside their minds for a moment. From their perspective, would there really be any conceivable downside to tearing the entire republic apart and simultaneously getting their hands around the throat of the reformist movement here in Siddermark? Zazin Kanya looked at her grim, lovely face for the better part of a minute and a half in silence. And then slowly, he shook his head. 7. Lord Protector Stonar's residence and the Carisian Embassy. Siddar City, Republic of Siddermark. "The temperature seems to be rising awfully sharply for September," Gregor Stonar said sourly, looking around the handsome inlaid table in the richly appointed library of the Lord Protector's personal residence. He could have held this meeting in his public office in the Lord Protector's palace off Constitution Square, but public offices were just that, public. Not even Henry Maiden's agents could be sure they weren't spies in his own staff, although it seemed unlikely. He was almost certain the group of four would have taken much more strenuous action against him long before now if Zaspar Clintan had managed to get a spy that close to him. On the other hand, he hadn't survived this long by taking anything for granted. "Temperatures tend to do that when someone starts blowing on the flames," Maiden said unhappily. "You're sure that's what's happening then?" Lord Samuel Goddard asked, his expression acutely unhappy. Maiden looked back at him and the Keeper of the Seal grimaced. "I realize you're not in the habit of just casually dropping unsubstantiated rumors on us, Henry, but if you're right about what's going on under the surface, we're about to land in a sea of trouble." "Then I recommend we all learn how to swim," Darius Parker, the Republic Seneschal, said harshly. Goddard's eyes moved to him, and Parker shrugged. "Every one of my agents is reporting exactly the same thing Henry's are, or the ones I'm sure haven't been suborned by the Pacover or Einhard anyway." He showed his teeth briefly. "Frankly, there aren't as many of those as I wish there were." Stonar ran his right hand through his hair, his expression rather more harried than he ever allowed it to look in public. It wasn't as if they hadn't seen this coming for quite some time, he reminded himself. There was, however, a difference between anticipating something at some unspecified future date and actually seeing it rumbling towards you like Shan Wei's salt grinder. "All right," he said after a moment. "I think we just answered the question of whether or not they're up to something. So it seems to me that the ones still before us are how soon they intend to move, how widely they intend to move, and exactly how they plan on all of this coming down in the end. I hope no one thinks my pointing out that those are rather broad questions," Goddard observed dryly. "I agree," Maiden nodded crisply and turned to the Lord Protector. I don't think we can answer any of them in any definitive sense. What does seem probable, though, is that they've been working on whatever they have in mind ever since Clintane sent us Pot Covert. I wouldn't be surprised if they'd had contingency plans basically forever, and when Karis declined to lie down and die, they decided to dust one off and update it to fit the new circumstances. I also think we can assume they'd really like for whatever they have in mind to happen before the snow starts flying. That would explain why their agitators are ratcheting the temperature up right now. They've only got about another month or a month and a half before winter closes in. You're probably right, Henry, Parker said. But let's not invest too much confidence in that timing. If we're looking at some widespread operation directed at the Republic as a whole, then, yes, they'd probably prefer to have it out of the way before winter starts cutting down on their mobility. If what they're planning is a more focused operation, something like seizing control of Sidar City and the government in a quick coup, rather than some popular general uprising by our outraged citizenry, with no outside provocation at all, of course, they might see winter weather as their ally. If they don't succeed in the first rush, bad weather would make it more difficult for us to bring in reinforcements from outlying regions that decided to remain loyal to us. A valid point, Stonar said. On the other hand, we're talking about Zaspar Clintane. He's not the sort to think small, and we've got reports of the same sort of propaganda and spontaneous organizations from at least a dozen other cities and towns. To me, that suggests he's thinking in terms of your widespread operation, Darius. I think we have to assume he is anyway, Maiden agreed. We'll be a lot better off planning against a bigger threat than we actually end up facing than underestimating the danger and getting our heads handed to us when the ship really starts flying. Granted, Parker agreed, and Stonar nodded. All right, we'll think in terms of an execution date on their part sometime in the next 2 months. If it turns out we've got longer, so much the better. Have we heard anything from Carneo or the lovely and devious Madame Parsan? Goddard asked wryly, and Stonar chuckled. Not directly, no. Then again, we're officially trying to arrest Carneo, as soon as we can find him, of course, and Madame Parsan doesn't know, officially at least, we're even aware of her activities. That makes it just a tiny bit difficult for them to openly share information with us. On the other hand, I suspect at least some of Henry's informants are really part of Madame Parsan's network. I think she's making sure we find out about certain things she's discovered. What I'm a lot less sure of is whether or not she's telling us everything she's discovered. The Lord Protector shook his head. The lady has an agenda of her own, and while I'm prepared to welcome just about any ally if this turns out as badly as we're afraid it could, I'm not about to assume she isn't feeding us selected information. I don't think she'd actually lie to us to get us to do what she wants, if only because she's foresighted enough to realize how badly that could hurt her with us down the road. But I'm positive she wouldn't be above manipulating information in order to prod us into doing what she wants. Whatever it turns out, that is.